supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Tom McDonald, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. The Philadelphia Eagles' Malcolm Jenkins is considered one of the best safeties in the NFL. Off the field, he's been advocating for criminal justice reforms, including a first-of-its-kind bill in Pennsylvania. WHYY's Katie Culinary has more.
Lately, Malcolm Jenkins has become less widely known for the tackles he's racked up than for his clenched fist. For the past year, Jenkins has started almost every game in silent protest.
Oh, say can you see?
While the national anthem blares out over some stadium, you'll see Jenkins standing stoically, holding his right fist above his head. It's his quiet way of reminding America about the racial injustice ever present in the lives of people of color like him. This year, Jenkins joined a group of NFL players on a visit to Capitol Hill to meet with lawmakers about criminal justice reforms on the national level.
What we took from that trip was that we could take that same model and apply it to a state and local level, and so that's what we did.
On Friday night, during a private event supporting a local nonprofit at an upscale Center City restaurant, Jenkins threw his support behind Pennsylvania's proposed Clean Slate Act. The law would automatically seal nonviolent misdemeanor convictions after 10 years for those who haven't committed another crime since.
It'll be the first legislation of its kind, you know, I believe, and it's one that I think is not the overall solution, but it's a step in the right direction.
It's not clear how many of the 3 million Pennsylvanians with a criminal record the bill might help. But reformers like Jamie Gullen with Community Legal Services of Philadelphia hope it'll be the first step to future reforms.
We'd like to advocate next for certain felony convictions to be sealed, especially drug offenses. We see a huge impact of that on our clients' lives.
Gullen hopes the legislation will become a model for other states. But first, the Clean Slate Act needs to get over the finish line. The Pennsylvania State Senate passed the bill unanimously in June, but it's still sitting in the House Judiciary Committee. It's not clear when it could come up for a vote. Jenkins hopes to find a time to sit down with state lawmakers in the coming weeks to express his support.
The criminal justice system has had a heavy hand on communities of color and in poor communities. And, you know, I've grown up and I can look, you know, as far as my brother and my cousins and see the effect that it's had on my family. And I think it's something that I could change.
Jenkins has been joined in his reform efforts by former wide receiver Anquan Boldin. In fact, Boldin retired from the NFL last month so he could focus his full attention on them. And like Jenkins, the cause is also personal. In October 2015, his cousin Corey Jones was fatally shot by a plainclothes police officer in Florida after his car broke down on the side of a highway. The officer, Newman Raja, was charged with manslaughter and has been under house arrest. The trial begins this fall. Boldin says he hopes the officer will be found guilty.
Just to be honest with you, he murdered my cousin. And to see him pay for that would be justice.
While he hopes fans will respond by contacting their representatives, Boldin says he and Jenkins are mainly trying to use their notoriety as athletes to meet with lawmakers face-to-face and tell them these issues must become a priority.
We're able to get different meetings from senators and congressmen that probably the ordinary person couldn't get. For some reason, people like sports, and they like to hear what we have to say. So I think it would be irresponsible of us to have that platform and not create change with it.
Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
I have a part-time job as an elected official and a full-time job here at the hardware store.
That's Margate Mayor Mike Becker, one of several at the Jersey Shore who are only part-time elected officials. Mayor Becker says it's not hard for his constituents to find him. All they have to do is go to the hardware store.
When I first ran 10 years ago, I said I would be accessible. I've lived up to that promise. I'm certainly willing to talk to the residents anywhere they want.
Is it fun for you?
It is, Tom. It's actually fun. People say, oh, you must be having a hard time. Even with the Dunes Project, it's still fun.
A little further down the parkway, Wildwood's mayor, Ernie Troiano, also runs a business. On many days, he can be found pouring concrete, weather permitting.
It's a balancing act. It's how to get to your customers, answer the phones, go out and see your customers, go out and do the job, go out and get paid. And in the meantime, What we normally do is we pour concrete first thing in the morning, then I run into City Hall when I get a chance, and I go back out, pour more, then I run back into City Hall.
Traiano says the key to going and doing the job is a phone with Bluetooth.
I don't wear an earpiece because being Italian, you can multitask. You know, we usually you have to talk with your hands. Me, I'm talking with the trowels. But people call, and you know, I tell them, I said, look, you know, if you don't mind, I'm working, but I'm happy to talk to you.
In Ocean City, New Jersey, Mayor Jay Gillian runs the family amusement park business in addition to running the city. On Labor Day, we celebrate all of the hardworking people who keep the engines of productivity humming. A lot of American workers spend their days in cubicles hidden behind drab fabric-covered walls. How did this little box become the place to work? WHYY's Mike and Scott has our story.
Cubicles seem to inspire a kind of existential angst in terms of our lives and what we're doing with our time. But don't blame the box for all of your woes, says Nikhil Saval. He's a Philadelphia writer and author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace.
The sort of dread and unhappiness that people associate with cubicles, it's not exactly just about the space itself, and it's not purely a design issue. It's just a symbol of a broader workplace problem.
A symbol of being boxed in with no opportunities for growth. But it was never meant to be this way. The cubicle was created by Robert Probst, a designer working at Herman Miller Office Furniture Company.
What he conceived of was not actually called the cubicle. He had something called the action office, this hinged three-walled structure that was meant to be very flexible. It could be shaped to have an individual office space, or it could be shaped to create a meeting. And the emphasis really was on action. I mean, if you look at images of it, people were constantly in motion in these spaces.
Each office is a mind-oriented action arena to provide privacy without isolation, involvement without a loss of individuality.
This is a commercial from the Herman Miller Archives. The new buzz phrase back then was knowledge work, and cubicles were supposed to facilitate this free flow of ideas and creativity.
It's a far better environment for today's changing functions, an instant, flexible office facility that can parallel the surging, turbulent business life it serves. This is indeed the age of change.
Action Office debuted in 1964.
It was deemed one of the most interesting and successful office designs ever, but it was copied very quickly by other office companies. And as they installed more and more of these into office spaces, they ended up becoming much more box-like because the managers found that it was actually an incredible tool for cramming as many people as possible, as cheaply as possible, into as little space as possible.
These days, a lot of companies are taking down the cubicle walls in favor of a more open floor plan, and some workplaces are taking things one step further.
People don't really have desks of their own, and this is already very commonplace in sort of future-minded offices, where people just come in and they take any desk that they want. Everything is sort of cloud-based. It's increasingly paperless. And it's increasingly nomadic.
Saval says employees tend to hate this design because they have trouble concentrating and there's absolutely no privacy. But despite that, open floor plans are becoming increasingly popular. So one day soon, we might all be missing those drab fabric-covered walls. I'm Mike and Scott, WHYY News.
It's September, which means it's time for the Fringe Festival once again. It's the 21st season of this annual theater festival in Philadelphia. With more than 150 events scattered across the city over 18 days, it can be a challenge to navigate. WHYY's Peter Crimmins sat down with NewsWorks theater blogger Howard Shapiro to offer some guidance.
It comes out with a very thick book. Around this time, you start flipping through the book, and we're trying to navigate. I'm here with Howie, and we're trying to navigate how to get through this book for another year of the Fringe Festival.
Yet another year, the 21st year. You know, it's a huge festival, and the book seems daunting. And everything in the book, of course, is on the Fringe Arts website. What you've got is 13 shows curated by the Fringe. They brought them here. They're producing them. You've got 158 shows in what I like to call the free-for-all Fringe, which is really independently produced. You know, you say, hey, I'm going to be in the Fringe, and you sign up and you put on a show. There are 17 digital shows. You don't have to move from your computer to see those, and they're all free. And then there's this huge late night schedule starting around 10 o'clock at the Fringe Arts Building at Columbus Avenue and Race, right by the Ben Franklin Bridge. How do you do it?
Right.
So the fun of it is, okay, for 60 or 90 minutes, I'm going to see something. I have no idea what it is. There you go. I'm going to be a risk taker in the arts.
Okay. And so, if you're a seasoned theater goer, you're going to recognize some names. You're going to recognize some companies. There are some people who have been doing The Fringe since it started 21 years ago.
I have a handy-dandy way of being a first-time Fringer.
Okay.
If you can't get the book, which is really fun to kind of leaf through, you can go to the website, and they have made it fairly simple to pick a show and understand what you're getting into. If you go to fringearts.com, Fringe Arts being one word, and then on the top you click on Festival, you'll see that you can scroll down on the left-hand side and pick a date. Now, The Fringe lasts 18 days. It starts September 7th. So you can pick a date that you might like to go, and what you'll get is a listing of all the shows. And all you have to do is hit a little red box by every show that says read more, and you'll say, maybe, or wow. And I don't know what that wow means, but you will when you read it. It's a fairly painless way to navigate The Fringe. You pick your night. You can also, I believe, categorize it by neighborhood, because The Fringe is in many neighborhoods in the city.
And the physical book, the program guide, is organized by neighborhood. So it's sectioned out by Old City, by South Philly, by Northern Liberties, by like Mount Airy. And so if you're going to dive in for a day or two and you say, I want to pick this day and I want to see whatever shows are in this vicinity, you can do that. I mean, you can stay in, and that's sometimes helpful because you can go to like two or three things in one evening, or if you can spend a Saturday, you can go to half a dozen things.
Yes, if you want.
And they're walkable. You can go walk between the venues. You can stop for lunch. You can have a drink in between shows, and you can really plan a day like that.
We ought to say really that because of the Fringe Festival, which has been very successful here and more than in other cities, New York's didn't even come off this year. Because of the Fringe Festival, Philadelphia audiences have really learned to accept new work. And during the regular theater season, when the 50 stage companies in this region that are professional put on new work, people go. So, you know, the Fringe has served its purpose in the larger world of the arts.
It certainly has. And I know a lot of companies that were starting 20-some years ago. The Pig Iron Theater, which is a very very well-established experimental theater company in this area, they were a couple of friends who came out of college. They studied theater. They wanted to start a new company. They were looking for a place to call home, and they were thinking of a lot of cities. And that's just when the Fringe Festival was getting started in Old City 20 years ago. And they thought, let's stay in Philadelphia because they have this Fringe thing, and it seems to be going in the direction we want to be in. So they stayed here, and now they have a brick-and-mortar school up in Northern Liberties. They've won an Obie, you know, in New York.
Oh, they're internationally known now.
There are lots and lots of – we can't possibly get into all the shows here that we would be here for days. But I know that later this week, you, Howie, will be releasing online on our website, newsworks.org, a list of productions that you find are notable.
Yeah, that I think that you are worth paying, you know, good attention to. And then a few days after that, later this week, I'm going to put my picks of the fringiest sounding shows. What's really on the edge or all past
right.
it.
All right. Well, I'm Peter Crimmins, and I'm here with Howie Shapiro. Thanks so much.
Tomorrow marks the 40th anniversary of the launch of NASA's Voyager 1 spacecraft, and it's still sending signals back to Earth. WHYY's Dave Heller followed its path with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute.
Derek, I'm a little confused. Now, Voyager 1 was part of a pair, but it left after Voyager 2. Did somebody make a mistake with the decals?
What actually happened was the trajectory that Voyager 2 and Voyager 1 would take were different trajectories, and the velocity of Voyager 1 would eventually overtake Voyager 2 on its way to the outer reaches of the solar system. The initial mission for these two was to look at the gas giants of our solar system in the outer reaches, Jupiter, Saturn. Those were the primary targets, and to bring us the first close-up images of these planets with their systems of moons, and also to bring us the first close-up images of the rings of Saturn.
But those targets and goals were attained a long time ago. Did scientists and astronomers in 1977 foresee still being able to maintain contact in 2017?
You know, I would bet that in their deepest dreams and fondest hopes and wishes that this would still be the case, but the primary mission was not anticipated as being this long. Those two spacecraft, 40 years later, are still doing good science and still sending us science data that tells us about the outer reaches of the solar system. These are our emissaries out into interstellar space.
But 40 years on, they're still within our solar system?
Well, that's debatable, actually. It seems as if they are now approaching what we think of as the outer boundary of our solar system, and that is the heliopause. That's the outer boundary of the reach of the sun's solar wind. So the electromagnetic particles that are generated by the sun reach out this far, but beyond this point, their influence is now becoming weaker than the influence of the surrounding interstellar space. Where one of the spacecraft is now at almost 13 billion miles out, we're starting to see this really interesting effect where the sensors on the spacecraft are sensing mostly solar wind and then not mostly solar wind, and then solar wind again, and then not mostly solar wind. And what this is showing us is that this far reach of the sun's field of electromagnetic particles really oscillates back and forth at its boundary. And pretty soon, within another billion miles or so, it will be fully outside that edge and into interstellar space.
Put those numbers in some perspective.
Well, if we go with the 13 billion miles where Voyager 1 is right now, that's 139 times the distance between the Earth and the sun. 139 times. One of the spacecraft is out of the plane of the solar system's orbits, and so it's traveling in a totally different trajectory. And the two of them really are expected to continue traveling on forever as long as nothing or no one interferes with them.
So it must take hours now at the speed of light for a signal to reach us.
Yes, the signal time is something like 16 hours to get a signal. And the signals are incredibly, incredibly weak, like millionths of a watt, if not weaker than that. So it's quite the chore for us to keep up with the spacecraft because of their extraordinary distance and the very, very, very weak signal. It takes almost the full capacity of our radio telescope network system around the world to hold on to the signal, understanding where the spacecraft are, and maintaining contact with them.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
Derek Pitts spoke with WHYY's Dave Heller. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Binyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. And special thanks tonight to Kim and engineer Bob Alls, who came into work on this Labor Day. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. On Wednesday, New Jersey's senior U.S. Senator Bob Menendez goes to trial in federal court. Tomorrow evening, we'll have a preview of the case, which stems from a 2015 indictment on federal corruption charges. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom McDonald for NewsWorks Tonight.